It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. People on the Gulf Coast who've lost money because of the BP oil spill have put a lot of hope in Kenneth Feinberg. He's the new claim czar appointed by the federal government to help with making people whole. He's been on the job nearly 3 weeks, and already there are complaints. His new system is just as frustrating as the old one run by BP. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
After being shuffled through 9 BP claims adjusters and having to resubmit tax records 3 times, Rhonda Drummond was ready for the switch.
We waited patiently until Feinberg took over. I was at the office at 8 o'clock.
She owns Duck's Diner in the resort town of Orange Beach, Alabama. Her husband and one son cook, another son waits tables. And when she's not fixing the squash and mashed potatoes for the lunch special, Rhonda Drummond is up front greeting customers, the few she still has.
Hey, y'all. How many we got today?
Five.
Let me get you set up, buddy.
The restaurant lost $45,000 this summer and only got $15,000 of it back from BP. That's why she was so anxious for Feinberg to take over.
And we filed for $120,000 to get us through till January. And they insulted my family by sending us $4,500. They gave my servers more than they gave our business.
By comparison, the $4,500 check makes BP look good for giving her $15,000, even though it was only a fraction of the diner's losses. Now, the new claims process does not allow appeals for the emergency payment, so she's not sure what to do next.
We can file the final claim, give up all right to sue, or we can retain an attorney, or we can file bankruptcy and walk away from it all. As a mother, how do you make that decision?
Businesses all along the Gulf Coast are struggling with similar choices after a summer season that was a bust because of the BP oil spill. Feinberg had promised a quick turnaround. If you had even minimal documentation, individuals would get a 6-month emergency payment within 48 hours of a claim. Businesses in a week. It sounded like a lifeline for those on the brink.
We were just putting all our hope into Feinberg. We have moved home. We've closed our office. We've had to cut our salaries. We're just barely making it.
That's Sheila Newman. She and her twin sister own Orange Beach Weddings. About a month ago, they described for NPR their fight with BP. Now the fight is with Feinberg's Gulf Coast Claims Facility.
We're going broke. We have no money. So the 7 days meant a lot to us. So we, you know, every day it's like, please let that check come in. But you check it and we're still under review.
Kenneth Feinberg will be in Alabama, Florida, and Louisiana next week to explain the delays.
Frustration is understandable. The frustration is to be acknowledged. We're processing about 1,000 claims a day. The problems are enormous.
Problems like duplicate claims or no proof of lost income. Still, Feinberg admits he promised more than he's been able to deliver, given the complexity and sheer volume of claims.
It's taken longer than I thought. And that criticism, the false expectations that have been raised, I think are justifiable.
Diner owner Rhonda Drummond says she can't wait any longer for the process to work.
Alone, I just want what's rightfully due me. What I would have done, what my family would have made, if they hadn't messed it up for us. That's all I'm asking for.
You can't treat people like this, she says. We live in America. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. While many graduate students are just getting started with their studies, commentator Adam Rubin is glad to have grad school behind him. Now he suggests some extracurricular reading to help other students survive the process. It's part of our series, Three Books, in which an author recommends three books on one theme.
Graduate students need higher stipends and easier access to poorly guarded bagels. You might think the last things they need are more books. After all, if you're in grad school, you're already busy writing your dissertation, which, of course, is a thick book that no one will ever read. But sometimes you need a break from doing the things grad students do, such as avoiding their advisors and listening to NPR. Here, then, are three books to help you survive grad school. If you've walked through an academic building in the past 10 years, chances are you've seen photocopies of Jorge Cham's hilarious comic strip, Piled Higher and Deeper. Grad students love to tape his drawings on office doors, next to takeout menus, and that photo of the postdoctoral fellow's dog wearing a hat. The comic strip, which chronicles a grad student's struggle through a PhD program, offers insight while hitting horrifyingly close to home. While earning your graduate degree, you'll also need the reassurance that others have undertaken riskier missions and survived. In Endurance, Shackleton's incredible voyage to the Antarctic, Alfred Lansing tells the true story of one such group. In 1914, Sir Ernest Shackleton and his party sail for Vassal Bay to make the first overland crossing of Antarctica. When their ship becomes stuck in pack ice, they decide to camp until the spring thaw, only to watch the boat get crushed instead of released. Like grad school, Endurance is a tale of discovery for discovery's sake, followed by hopeless entrenchment in an overwhelming situation. The story also offers encouragement. No matter how bored you are during your department's next seminar, at least you aren't being attacked by a sea leopard while clinging to an ice floe in the Weddell Sea. And finally, if you've ever had to grade an undergraduate's essay, and you're sick of the misspellings, arbitrary grammar, and emoticons, find solace in Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, Lynn Truss's emphatic campaign against improper punctuation. Truss empowers the reader, armed with whiteout and a Sharpie, to fix the world's extraneous or missing apostrophes. Featuring a list of fitting punishments for those who confuse ITS and IT apostrophe S, this book is perfect for any grad student. You may even want to give a copy to the undergrad who sent you the email saying, "Im in ur 10 o'clock class, can I have extension smiley face?" Armed with these three books, you're ready for the languorous slog of post-baccalaureate education. Now, if only you had time to read them.
That's commentator Adam Rubin, the author of another book on this theme. It's called Surviving Your Stupid, Stupid Decision to Go to Grad School.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is in Afghanistan. We'll hear the first of her reports next week. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The most terrifying month of the financial crisis is now 2 years behind us.
In September 2008, the Lehman Brothers investment bank failed, and Americans contemplated the chances that the economy would collapse.
2 years later, recovery has begun, but it's slowing down. That's the opinion of Republicans criticizing the Obama administration.
It's also the view of liberal economist Robert Reich. He compares the economy to a tortoise trying to get out of a deep ravine who's just begun to scale the wall when he gets tired and goes to sleep.
We're going to talk about that tortoise with David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest on Morning Edition. David, good morning once again.
Good morning, Steve.
Do policymakers agree on what, if anything, is wrong here?
No.
Okay, thanks very much, David. That's all we wanted to know. Please go on.
They agree. Almost everybody agrees that the economy is unfortunately slowing down, the recovery running out of steam prematurely with still so many workers without jobs. Some people think the problem is that President Obama administered the wrong medicine, and they want different medicine. That's pretty much the Republican view. And others, particularly among liberal Democrats, think he just didn't administer enough medicine, and if only had enough gumption, he could put more stimulus into the economy, more medicine, another dose, and things would get better.
So what are the options now?
Well, the problem is that there are lots of options out there, lots of things that economists on the left and right might prescribe, but very little political will to agree to do any of them. President Obama, as we've seen in the last week and I'm sure at his press conference today, is going to revive some old proposals, make a few new ones. The only thing we know for sure is he's not going to call for more stimulus. That's become a dirty word, but he's got a bunch of business-friendly tax cuts that he says will get the economy going again. John Boehner, who's the closest thing to a Republican leader at the moment as the minority leader of the House, has what he calls a two-part plan, which is cut spending to fiscal 2008 levels, protecting security spending, and extend the Bush tax cuts. And he says that'll get things going again.
So both sides are talking about some form of tax cuts, but what else besides that?
Well, the president says that we should spend more money, but he wants to spend it on infrastructure, rails, roads, and runways, he says, figuring that that would put people to work. We have a lot of unemployed construction workers, and would also leave the country with something that would pay off in the future, a better infrastructure. The Republicans, who are very much both ideologically and seeing what the polls are saying that voters want, emphasizing the need to cut spending in order to get the deficit down, even though they also want to cut taxes, which would tend to get the deficit up. And it's not clear that either side has enough votes to get their things through. So the most likely scenario is nothing happens until the election. Maybe if the economy continues to deteriorate, something happens in a lame duck session.
David Wessel, I want to make sure I understand what you're telling me here, because you said stimulus is now a dirty word. Stimulus, of course, is what was used to refer to the giant bill that was passed at the beginning of the Obama administration, a combination of tax cuts and increased spending, deficit spending by the government to spur on the economy. You're saying nobody wants to say stimulus anymore, but people are still talking about deficit spending, tax cuts, and so forth.
That's right. The stimulus has become a bad word, I think, because many Americans think we had this big dose of fiscal stimulus and we still have a lousy economy, so it didn't work. So the president's economists, many of whom would like to do more stimulus, are trying to find other ways to describe what amounts to much the same thing. They call it what's good for long-term growth with a short-term kick or something like that.
Which is a little more awkward than just saying stimulus, I suppose.
Well, they're not in the business of making language less awkward.
No, not at all. Well, if Congress is going to be struggling to do anything in this situation, can the Federal Reserve do anything?
Well, maybe. That's a good question. They're not likely to do much when they meet it next week, September 21st. But with inflation running below their target and unemployment running well above their target, they're at least contemplating really the only thing they can do. They can't cut interest rates any further. They're already nearly to zero. They could buy more bonds in the bond market. That would help push down long-term interest rates and get more money sloshing around the economy. And they are contemplating that, although clearly they're not ready to do it yet.
David, always a pleasure to talk with you.
You're welcome.
That's David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. The world of higher education is preparing for a crackdown on its fastest-growing sector, for-profit colleges and universities. The Department of Education is proposing to tighten rules on just how much debt students at these schools can rack up. Students at for-profits are more likely to get in over their heads than those at not-for-profit schools. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, for-profit schools are fighting hard against the new rule because it would threaten their bottom line.
Last month, the Department of Education released a proposal that would say to for-profit schools, your graduates must earn at least enough to start repaying the federally backed loans we're giving you. If they can't, you could lose access to those loans. The reaction in the stock market was immediate.
Volatility is actually an understatement.
Jeffrey Silber with BMO Capital Markets says that stock prices for the parent companies of the University of Phoenix, Strayer University, and others have been crashing. Investors fear tighter regulation will bring an end to skyrocketing growth. At the same time, Silber says there's worry that an improving economy will slow enrollment in disciplines that have steadily added students during the recession.
You know, certificate non-degree programs, becoming a medical assistant, et cetera. Those folks, if the job market is good, will go right into the job market without this training.
A growing number of traders are betting on a crash in stock prices. William Duff Gordon of a firm called Data Explorers says some companies have become targets for short traders who hunt for stocks that are expected to fall.
If I look at Strayer Education, yeah, maybe only 5% of its shares were borrowed for shorting purposes, 2 years ago compared to 25% today.
The for-profit education business has responded with an aggressive education campaign. At least that's what they call it. They've been urging students to write letters to the government during the comment period on the rule. One for-profit company, Education Management Corporation, has hired a Washington lobbying firm to mount a campaign against the rule. The company has even offered to cover postage for employees who want to send a letter to the Department of Education. Many companies see this rule as a threat to their survival. Some depend on federally backed student loans for nearly 90% of their revenue. Harris Miller of the Career College Association makes no bones about the fact that his members are urging people to pressure the government.
We think it's not only ethical, but we think it's appropriate and necessary to educate people who might and should be concerned about this regulation to submit comments.
The for-profit education business has also launched its own research institute to try to counteract negative impressions the public has about schools that make a profit. Harris Miller says the government's own numbers underscore that for-profit education is here to stay and can't be treated as some sort of marginal phenomenon.
The Department of Education released data that showed that our sector has continued to grow overall to the point where we're now about 12% of all students in higher education, as opposed to about 9.5% the previous year.
Proponents of the new rule say they're not interested in driving for-profits out of business. They just want to stop students from borrowing more than they can afford to repay. Pauline Abernathy of the Institute for College Access and Success says the information battle shows just how much money is at stake here.
That they can hire companies to write comments for students and employees in order to try to defend the school's access to the federal student aid.
The public comment period on the new regulations ends this week. The impact of the rule on students and on for-profit schools won't be clear until the new rule is issued in November. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's rare for a writer to make the cover of Time magazine, so it was big news in the literary world when Jonathan Franzen was on a Time cover last month before the publication of his new book, Freedom, his first novel since his 2001 bestseller, The Corrections. Then came a front-page review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review that described Freedom as a masterpiece of American fiction. And people started taking sides, before the book was even published, about whether Franzen and his novel were worthy of the praise and attention. Now you can read it for yourself. It was published last week. In a few minutes, Jonathan Franzen will read from and talk about his new novel, Freedom. But first, our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review, along with some thoughts about the critical storm this novel has already stirred up.
Jonathan Franzen is in trouble again. You'll recall that back in 2001, Franzen made the misstep of expressing authorly ambivalence about the fact that his novel, The Corrections, might be mistaken for a women's only read since it had been chosen for Oprah's on-air book club. Soon enough, Oprah booted The Corrections off her syllabus, and Franzen got the reputation in some circles of being a snoot. Now all the hullabaloo over Franzen's long-awaited new novel, Freedom, is generating something of a feminist backlash. Why all this adulatory attention, critics ask, for Franzen's latest domestic drama about marriage and family? So many terrific contemporary female novelists cover the same terrain, yet their work receives a fraction of the highbrow fanfare that greets Franzen. It's like how men still get praise for doing housework and taking care of their own kids. Any male involvement in the domestic realm still merits applause. All true. And yet, even though Franzen gets more praise for doing what many fine women writers do, backwards and in heels, in the case of the blandly titled Freedom, it's well deserved. I heretically think Freedom is even more powerful than The Corrections, sections of which I found contrived. Freedom is looser and more revelatory and ambitious. It's the novel, by a man, along with novels by women like Allegra Goodman, Lionel Shriver, and the incandescent Sue Miller, that I'd elect to put in a time capsule to give a sense of the texture of middle-class American life to future readers. The husband and wife at the center of scrutiny in Freedom are Walter and Patty Berglund, who meet in college in the 70s. We know that Walter is in for a rough time when we're told at the outset that his most salient quality, besides his love of Patty, was his niceness. Patty, in the opening paragraphs of the novel, is the reigning stay-at-home mom of her gentrified neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota, a crafting and cooking queen. But a crack in Patty's chipper, progressive, democratic demeanor soon surfaces when we learn she slashed the tires of a noisy Republican lout who lives next door. Soon all hell breaks loose as the Berglund's adored teenage son Joey literally defects over the fence to live with the neighbor's vacant and sexually voracious daughter. Even worse, Joey will go on to work for shady civilian contractors supplying defective truck parts to the American forces in Iraq. And then there's Walter's best friend from college, Richard Katz, an aging bad boy and lead singer of an indie band called The Traumatics. Richard turns up erratically in the Berglund's life and simply by his very existence reminds Patty that although she married Walter, she was only, at best, somewhat more than sort of into him. The unspooling of the Berglund's marriage as they become more and more their destined selves is chronicled through a variety of perspectives, including a brutal but often hilarious therapeutic memoir that Patty writes, entitled Mistakes Were Made. One of the great pleasures of reading Franzen's work is savoring how he turns personalities this way and that, so that, for instance, from one angle, Patty is a victim. From another, she's a shrewish and controlling depressive. And all interpretations are somewhat true. Even Richard, who could so easily have devolved into a rock and roll stereotype, is dense and surprising. Because he's a cynic, Richard is also the source of some of the sharpest takes on his friends and the world they live in. Midway through the novel, Richard achieves mid-level fame. Here are his thoughts about a young girl who won't stop bothering him. She was like a walking advertisement of the late model parenting she'd received. You have permission to ask for things. Your offerings, if you're bold enough to make them, will be welcomed by the world. Richard wondered if he'd been this tiring himself at 18, or whether, as it now seemed to him, his anger at the world, his perception of the world as a hostile adversary worthy of his anger, had made him more interesting than these young paragons of self-esteem. There's not one throwaway scene in Freedom, and yet for all that effort, nothing feels overwritten or false. Like the corrections, Freedom celebrates and extends the possibilities of the good old realist novel at a time when realism is out of fashion, even in autobiography. Franzen makes us skeptical postmoderns believe again, if only for a space, that literature really can and should hold a mirror up to the world.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom.
Our film critic Kenneth Turan would like to unravel the true story of a new documentary. As with reality TV shows, it's hard to know how much reality there is in the film I'm Still Here.
I'm Still Here is being presented as a documentary, a behind-the-scenes portrayal of a tumultuous year in the life of actor Joaquin Phoenix. It was a time when the two-time Oscar nominee insisted he was leaving acting to begin a career in rap music.
Phoenix to see Diddy, Mr. Combs, Sean.
For advice, he goes to celebrated music producer Sean Combs.
Do you have any money?
I have a little studio, do you know? I have a garage, got Pro Tools set up.
See, that's a mother problem.
Yes, how much?
Craft services.
Yeah, it costs a lot.
Studio, engineer.
I got it.
Me.
Well,
me.
Yeah, you.
It all culminates in his famous meltdown on The David Letterman Show.
You're not going to act anymore?
No.
Huh. Why is that?
I don't know.
The overweight, slovenly, and stoned actor we see is very much a man in crisis. His life would be a sad and horrifying cautionary tale if all this were true. The question is it? I'm Still Here is persuasive, but by the time it was over, I felt I'd been watching a very clever and convincing hoax. The drug use, the sexual escapades, the assistants who enable, the all-around bad behavior, they could conceivably be true, but they are too close to confirming every cliched prejudice to be totally credible. I'm Still Here is directed by Casey Affleck, who is also Phoenix's brother-in-law. It's possible that the actor, genuinely interested in taking some time away from the movies, saw an opportunity to pull off what he envisioned as a performance piece that would last for months. Phoenix and Affleck could also be trying to have some fun and games at the expense of the voracious celebrity media industry. How better to metaphorically stick a finger in the eye of the media than entice them to feast on bogus celebrity misadventures? Fake or not, I'm Still Here is no fun to watch. Filming someone having a mental breakdown is embarrassing and exploitative at best, and the notion that director Affleck would take advantage of his own brother-in-law this way doesn't hold water. even in Hollywood.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you.